dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or Free Radio Asheville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. February is Black History Month, and tonight we're going to hear some of the hard edge of the history of Africans and their descendants in America. This history is of enormous importance, and not just for black folks. I think in some ways, white folks are in the gravest need of understanding the significance of the black experience in America, because it is impossible, in the face of any accurate rendition of that history, to sustain the edifice of myths about the United States as the noble nation, spreading its benevolence across the globe, that is an obligatory mantra for every political candidate and nattering nabob. There are certainly some good people in this country, and some of them I know personally, and some Americans have done and are doing great and worthy things. Some of them will be mentioned on the program tonight. But as a nation, the United States of America is a predator of unprecedented ferocity. It began with genocide as fortune hunters from Europe seeking land, gold, and Lebensraum arrived on these shores and massacred almost the entire native population. With this stolen land, the wealth of the nation was built through the forced labor of tens of millions of African people kidnapped from their homes and turned into chattel slaves. Claiming a divine right of possession ordained by God, termed manifest destiny, they murdered and robbed from sea to shining sea. They declared the Monroe Doctrine, deeming that all lands in the hemisphere were also subject to their dictates. This has now been extended to the entire planet, where any amount of murderous force may be applied, when justified in terms of U.S. interests, which translates in plain English as protecting the profit and power of America's rich men. The perpetrators of this bloodbath have not been outlaws for the most part, but law-abiding citizens, for the very simple reason that the perpetrators themselves made the laws and continue to make the laws. It is apt to point this out, as we are told that our great leaders reflect Christian moral values that are supposedly the overriding concern of American voters these days. These moral values, they say, are embodied in the Ten Commandments, which, last I heard, prohibit killing, stealing, greed, and lying. How is this moral framework reconciled with actual practice? In the mind-numbing process of indoctrination known as the teaching of history in schools, we learn of Alexander of Macedonia, who conquered the known world by the time he was 25. They didn't call him the Hitler of the ancient world. No, they called him the Great. Then there's Rome, sending out its legions to conquer and exact tribute from far-flung lands. This is somehow portrayed as glorious. We have Christopher Columbus, who initiated a process of conquistadors in, galleons filled with gold out, and he has a holiday. Then the mighty British Empire, upon which the sun always shines. All positive-sounding portrayals of what was actually programmatic murder and looting, kinda like Operation Iraqi Liberation. We also learned in school about Genghis Khan, a bloodthirsty conqueror who led hordes, the vicious Ottoman Turks, and of course those barbaric Aztecs who sacrificed their imperial captives on bloody altars. What enabled one to separate the good plunderers from the bad? The missing link in this chain of moral incongruity is racism. Racism is the magical formula used to transform murder and plunder into acts of moral virtue. Racism is the magical formula used to render rape and other acts of torture legally invisible. Listen.
Spirit of the dead, rise up! Lingering spirit of the dead, rise up and possess your bird of passage. Those stolen Africans, step out of the ocean, from the wombs of the ships, and claim your story. Spirit of the dead, rise up. Lingering spirit of the dead, rise up and possess your vessel. Those Africans, shackled in leg irons and enslaved, step out of the acres of cane fields and cotton fields and tell your story. Spirit of the dead, rise up. Lingering spirit of the dead, rise up and possess your bird of passage. Those lynched in the magnolias, swinging on the limbs of the weeping willows, rotting food for the vultures, step down and claim your story. Spirit of the dead, rise up. Lingering spirit of the dead, rise up and possess your vessel. Those tied, bound, and whipped from Brazil to Mississippi, step out and tell your story. Those in Jamaica, in the fields of Cuba, in the swamps of Florida, the rice fields of South Carolina, you waiting Africans, step out and tell your story. Spirit of the dead, rise up. Lingering spirit of the dead, rise up and possess your bird of passage. From Alabama to Suriname, up to the caves of Louisiana, come out, you African spirits. Step out and claim your stories. You raped, slave bred, castrated, burned, tarred and feathered, roasted, chopped, lobotomized, bound and gagged, you African spirits, spirit of the dead, rise up. Lingering spirit of the dead, rise up and possess your bird of passage.
Jay means listen. Listen up, y'all. This is a Black History Month collaboration between Rootwork and Slave Revolt Radio. My name is Mama Kaliba.
And I'm Gerald Smith.
And today, we want to talk about a lot of things in regards to Black History Month. We want to talk about the Black history that we don't usually get. The Black history of rebellion, resistance to enslavement, oppression, present-day resistance.
That's right. We also want to introduce the discipline of science in some of our analysis and critique of the historical record. For instance, how many slaves actually died during the Black Holocaust? I'm talking here now about the slave trade. Well, most people don't realize that for every one slave that made it, let's say, to the United States, five died in Africa fighting back and resisting their kidnapping and original imprisonment and enslavement. And then that horrible ride across the Atlantic Ocean took its share. Sometimes you may be aware of this, that the captains of the ships during the slave suppression of the slave trade would actually throw slaves overboard rather than to be captured with slaves, arrested, and put into prison. Throw human lives overboard. This was a common practice, and that is why that figure is so high. Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois estimated that the total number of Africans who died due to the Black Holocaust was 100 million.
Coming from Africa into America, just that figure alone.
That's right.
Not those who died before they got on the ship. Not those who died once they docked.
No, that's right. He's talking about
just the trip over here.
Yep.
Is 100 million people.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think he might be counting also. They had these prisons that they maintained up and down the coast of West Africa that held the future slaves until the ships would come and get them. Mm-hmm. I think he was counting that also.
Okay. So that's 100 million people that we don't usually hear about, that we don't usually talk about. 100 million people. What's the population of the state of California? Is it 100 million people?
No.
The population of California and Texas and New York.
Probably 100 million altogether.
So all of those states, maybe even throw in a couple of more.
Mm-hmm.
100. Imagine if all of the population of California, Texas, and New York just dropped away, just disappeared. Welcome tomorrow, everybody gone.
That's right.
100 million people gone from Africa.
It had a devastating effect on Africa. Devastating.
Not only do we not talk about that cost, what we do talk about, and we talk about inaccurately, is the treatment of slaves once they hit the shores here. We are usually told through, quote-unquote, learned scholars that the slaves were happy, that they were docile, that they were treated comfortably, they were treated well, and that once emancipation came, there was pandemonium. Oh, Lordy, Lordy, what we're going to do now?
Yeah.
That's what we're usually told. But once again, that's another lie also.
Nothing could be further from the truth.
Absolutely nothing.
In fact, according to Anta Diop, a famous African scientist, in his book, Civilization or Barbarism, he says, imperialism, like the prehistoric hunter, first killed the being spiritually and culturally before trying to eliminate it physically. Mm-hmm. The negation of the history and the intellectual accomplishments of Black Africans was cultural mental murder, which preceded and paved the way for their genocide here and there in the world. This, unfortunately, is something that we're still suffering from to this day.
Mm-hmm. Genocide, that's a strong word. Very strong word. But as I said, it was not all happy, docile, yes, a mass of slaves. There was fighting going on. There was fighting going on in the bush in Africa. There was fighting going on as we made it our way down to the shores, down to those camps, to those prisons along the western coast of Africa. There was fighting on the ships.
That's right.
There was a lot of fighting on them ships.
That's right.
There was fighting once we docked those ships.
You know something that really disturbs me? I read a book called The History of African Slave Revolts by a guy named Apthecker, I think it was.
Herbert Apthecker.
Herbert Apthecker. And he enumerates many, many, many different events that were actually slave revolts. Mm-hmm. And what occurred was, at the time, a lot of the academics attacked Dr. Apthecker because they said, well, wait a minute, there's no clear record. It wasn't in the newspaper. It was not put in these racist histories that the Southern racists wrote themselves. How could it be? These acts of defiance, successful or not, were not recorded for the very reason that the white slave masters could not sleep with the idea that they had arrested, aggressive slave force underneath their nose. After Nat Turner carried out his action, the slave revolt that he led, the South became an armed camp. And that's when you saw a lot of these black codes about what blacks couldn't do and could do. Blacks couldn't learn how to read. Illegal to teach blacks to learn how to read.
The thing about resistance to slavery, though, is because we live under a patriarchal system in addition to a capitalistic system, there's a lot of macho and bravado that we live under, that colors our history and our perceptions. So the assumption is that if the slaves did not pick up arms or fashion arms and kill people, there was no resistance. But there's what you call day-to-day resistance.
Absolutely.
Whereas I might not pick up a hoe and crack Mass upside his head. I might just break the hoe.
Or poison him.
I might just say, I lost the hoe. I'm sick. I can't work today.
That's right.
Or maybe Mass will wake up dead because his trusted house slaves who were learned in the herbalism of their day from their native continent and in conjunction with Native Americans here and studying their environment, maybe they knew which plants to sweeten up the soup with. Mm-hmm. And Massa and Missy Ann woke up dead one morning.
That's right.
So there are lots of acts of day-to-day resistance that do not qualify as armed acts of resistance, but it slowed down and it sabotaged the economy of slavery nonetheless.
Not only did blacks begin to resist as soon as they set foot in this, quote, great land, unquote, but there were movements formed by blacks to win the freedom of the slaves. So, for instance...
But before we talk about that, the other thing that Dr. Herbert Aptheker did, he wrote an essay about 1939 that talked about maroons within the present limits of the United States. Usually when we hear the word maroon, we think of course, Jamaica and of Haiti and of Brazil, of Palmares, of Quilombos. And, of course, there were maroons there, but there were also maroons here in the United States of America. As a matter of fact, that corridor known as the Great Dismal Swamp from Virginia to North Carolina was the home of at least 2,000 maroons. This is the swamp area that Nat Turner fled into after his rebellion had been crushed. That was where he ran to. So it didn't just pop up in 1831. It had been there since the first Africans had hit these shores. So there were maroons in Florida, in Georgia, off the coast of Alabama and Mobile. So running away and forming alternative communities, alternative settlements, was an act of resistance, not just to live alternatively, but these settlements served as bases to raid the plantations, to attack the plantations, to nurture and harbor insurrectionary leaders. They would go down into the plantations and not just destroy crops and steal seeds, they would steal people also.
Since we're talking about it, let's talk about the Seminole Nation and the fact that for over 100 years, Florida was off limits for the United States, for the 13 original colonies, because many blacks would escape from Georgia, Mississippi, and go and stay with the Seminole Indians and became a part of their culture and jointly resisted any attempt to be re-enslaved. And they were finally defeated by Andrew Jackson, 100 years after this bond had been made.
Andrew Jackson, that was what, 1840s, or was that?
I think it was 1830, actually.
So from, quote-unquote, 1619, when the first 20 Africans landed, to about 18, whenever, that's over 200 years
right.
of resistance.
Yeah. And then, I just want to say, there was also conscious resistance, as I was speaking of before, of the abolitionists, who were the revolutionaries of their day. They wanted to bring down the slave system. Unfortunately, differences of opinion did develop within the abolitionists, and the black abolitionists decided to leave and form their own independent organizations, largely because they did not want to limit the struggle for black freedom to moral suasion, as many in the abolitionist movement did at that time. But remember, John Brown, a sterling example of a man totally dedicated to bringing an end to slavery. In fact, at Harper's Ferry, he initiated the Civil War. And all along, while this was happening, to show you how happy, quote-unquote, black people were, there was a consistent stream of Africans freeing themselves with the help of others in the Underground Railroad.
Mm-hmm. The Underground Railroad, just one of many links in this legacy of resistance to enslavement, this legacy of black liberation, that continues to this day.
Let the word go forth here and now that the struggle for freedom is still alive, and the story of that struggle is still being told. We begin with guttural cries and wrenching moans and visceral groans and weary lament and silent tears. And how this grand people of African descent could transfigure such misery into joy and a sense of sustaining themselves against overwhelming odds. What a story, what a drama. Vicious theft from Africa. Pernicious passage to the New World America.
atrocious enslavement on ugly plantations. Yet in wooden churches on God-forsaken creeks, in makeshift churches, they would forge a connection with a biblical story.
Every child will go
running for Jesus,
just like an automobile.
The first great art created in America. The spirituals proclaiming the good news in bad news situations. Connecting the sense of self against a society that told them they were nobody and no one. Keep keeping on was the theme. And then the painful laughter of the grand art. The blues themselves, the tragic comic sensibility of keeping on against the odds. Being down so long, the down don't worry us no more, and keeping on anyhow. Nothing like it in the world. Private agony and public misery could still not hold us back. We never allow misery to have the last word, even if all you could do is sing a song or a little moan. Or even crack a smile. Then the most sophisticated, the most refined art ever created, not just in America, but in the 20th century. Jazz itself. European instruments. New World African sensibility. The fusion of finding your own voice, but always in community, bouncing off against other voices to elevate the high quality of the collective performance of the quartet, or the orchestra, or the quintet, or maybe just a solo. Too many geniuses to mention, but Armstrong and Ellington and Monk and Coltrane and Vaughan and Holiday will have to do just at the moment. And then rhythm and blues, mellow, the sharing of soothing sweetness. We thank Brother Derek Allen and his musical genius for providing contribution in the tradition of Marvin Gaye, Luther Vandross, Curtis Mayfield, Aretha Franklin, and so many innumerable others. And then comes hip-hop, the greatest creative breakthrough in the last 25 years of the younger generation, fusing linguistic virtuosity with rhythmic velocity, something unprecedented as well as the other earlier developments in the history of not just black music, 20th century music, modern music, all connected to struggle for freedom. The music soothes our bruises. It caresses our bruises. It attempts to give us a foretaste of the freedom we so deeply want, even if we can experience it only for a moment. The struggle goes on. The story must be told and retold. Every generation must be connected to that story to be linked to that struggle for freedom. Come with us as we unfold the story and lay bare the drama.
Now we're going to talk a little bit about the relationship between capitalism and slavery. I'm going to mention a few books that I think it might be in your interest to check out at your leisure. One of those books is Capitalism and Slavery by Eric Williams. He points out in the book, and I quote, "The profits obtained from the slave trade provided one of the main streams that accumulation of capital in England, which financed the Industrial Revolution." Well, this is a very important concept that unfortunately not all of us seem to understand, and here's why it matters. You want to understand this concept because by understanding how the capitalist system developed in the first place, we can understand the unique role that black slavery played in it. Here's another book that you might want to check out. Walter Rodney's How Europe Underdeveloped Africa. And he makes this point about the slave trade. The process by which captives were obtained on African soil was not trade at all. It was through warfare, trickery, banditry, and kidnapping. When one tries to measure the effects of European slave trading on the African continent, it is very essential to realize that one is measuring the effect of social violence rather than trade in any normal sense of the word. Walter Rodney then goes on to talk about how important, what a devastating role the slave trade played on the economy of Africa by taking away healthy people in their, you know, in their prime. The slave traders were very clear. They didn't want to take elderly people or infirm people. No, no. They took the healthiest people they could lay their thieving hands on. And then what do? You take these people out of an existing economy. Well, what happens to that economy? It actually shrinks. And as Mr. Walter Rodney points out, this stunted the growth of Africa. If you look at the population for Africa and the growth of the population in Europe, between the beginnings of, you know, when slavery really started to take off, and let's say early 1900, the European population grew fourfold. That is, it went from roughly 100 million to 400 million, while Africa went from 100 million to 120 million. That is the direct results from 100 million to 120 million. Think about that, how devastating slavery and colonialism was towards black folks. Now, you should also understand that when we talk about, you know, slavery and capitalism, we should understand slaves were commodities. That's right, a commodity. Something that is sold and bought. But at the same time, slaves provided their labor. So not only were they commodities, but they created wealth. And boy, oh boy, did they create some. This process of creating wealth or increasing the value of other commodities is at the core of capitalism. And basically, the slaves, through their activities, created the economic basis to make America a world power. This is, I think, a point that should never be lost when we examine American history. Very often you hear, well, y'all didn't have no money. What did y'all bring? Yeah, as if slavery was some form of a failure. Our labor was a significant contribution to the development of this country. Now, growing capitalism in Europe, particularly in England, as I said, profited hugely from the highly lucrative slave trade. Slave voyages produced usually from 100 to 1,000% profit. In the 18th century, slaves cost about $50 in Africa and sold for up to $400 in the West Indies. Among the innumerable surviving profit and loss statements of the slave ships is the following. Captain Theodore Canitz reports that on a typical trip, his expenses were $39,980 and his net profit was $41,438. That is a lot of profit, y'all. Check that out. He also reported that the British ship Enterprise cleared $24,000 on 392 slaves. Slavers during this period figured out that if they successfully evaded pirates and other types of sea marauders, the hazards of the sea, and they got through with one cargo of slaves out of three, they would become rich. Is it any wonder that later on, when the slave trade was being suppressed, that they threw the slaves overboard to evade prosecution? Think about it. The English slave trade grew to enormous proportions during the 18th century. Liverpool was particularly built upon slave trading. And strangely enough, Liverpool to this day has a fairly large black community in England. But the point we're trying to make really here is that cotton was the material foundation. It was the stuff through which the British could turn on those looms, sell that material, and make millions more. Karl Marx points out that the profits of the murderous African slave trade were one of the major sources of primitive accumulation of British capitalism. From this trade were largely derived the resources which financed the Industrial Revolution in England. Marx says, and I quote, "The discovery of gold and silver in America, the extirpation, enslavement, and entombment in mines of the aboriginal population, the beginning of the conquest and looting of the East Indies, the turning of Africa into a warren for the commercial hunting of black skins, signalized the rosy dawn of the era of capitalist production. These idyllic proceedings are the chief momenta of primitive accumulation." Referring to England during the later American Civil War period, Marx shows the dependence of British industry upon slavery. Slavery is an economic category like any other. Direct slavery, just as much the pivot of bourgeois industry as machinery, credits, etc. Without slavery, you have no cotton. Without cotton, you have no modern industry. It is slavery that has given the colonies their value. It is the colonies that have created world trade, and it is the world trade that is the precondition of large-scale industry. Thus, slavery is an economic category of the greatest importance. Unquote. By the same token, the slave trade also helped lay the basis for industry here in the United States.
The general sentiment of mankind is that a man who will not fight for himself when he has the means of doing so is not worth being fought for by others, and this sentiment is just. For a man who does not value freedom for himself will never value it for others, or put himself to any inconvenience to gain it for others. Such a man, the world says, may lie down until he has sense to stand up. It is useless and cruel to put a man on his legs if the next moment his head is to be brought against a curbstone. A man of that type will never lay the world under any obligation to him, but will be a moral pauper, a drag on the wheels of society. And if he too be identified with a peculiar variety of the race, he will entail disgrace upon his race as well as upon himself. The world in which we live is very accommodating to all sorts of people. It will cooperate with them in any measure which they propose. It will help those who earnestly help themselves, and will hinder those who hinder themselves. It is very polite, and never offers its services unasked. Its favors to individuals are measured by an unerring principle in this, to wit: respect those who respect themselves, and despise those who despise themselves. It is not within the power of unaided human nature to persevere in pitying a people who are insensible to their own wrongs and indifferent to the attainment of their own rights. The poet was as true to common sense as to poetry when he said, "Who would be free themselves must strike the blow." When O'Connell, with all Ireland at his back, was supposed to be contending for the just rights and liberties of Ireland, the sympathies of mankind were with him, and even his enemies were compelled to respect his patriotism. Kossuth, fighting for Hungary with his pen, long after she had fallen by the sword, commanded the sympathy and support of the liberal world till his own hopes died out. The Turks, while they fought bravely for themselves and scourged and drove back the invading legions of Russia, shared the admiration of mankind. They were standing up for their own rights against an arrogant and powerful enemy. But as soon as they let out their fighting to the Allies, admiration gave way to contempt. These are not the maxims and teachings of a cold-hearted world. Christianity itself teaches that a man shall provide for his own house. This covers the whole ground of nations as well as individuals. Nations, no more than individuals, can innocently be improvident. They should provide for all wants, mental, moral, and religious, and against all evils to which they are liable as nations. In the great struggle now progressing for the freedom and elevation of our people, we should be found at work with all our might, resolved that no man or set of men shall be more abundant in labors, according to the measure of our ability, than ourselves.
That clip was taken from a speech by Frederick Douglass, "Where there is no struggle, there is no progress." It was read by Ossie Davis, who we will cover later on in this broadcast. Frederick Douglass was born into slavery in 1817 in Tuckahoe, Maryland, because his slave mother, Harriet Bailey, used to call him her little Valentine. He adopted February 14th as his birthday, not knowing the exact date of his birth. He knew very little about his mother since she was employed as a field hand on a plantation some 12 miles away, and she died when he was 8 or 9 years old. Douglass knew even less about his father, but it was rumored that he was the son of his white slave master, Aaron Anthony. Young Frederick was grossly mistreated. To keep from starving on many occasions, he competed with his master's dog for table scraps and bones. In 1825, he was sent to serve as a houseboy in a home of Hugh and Sophie Ard in Baltimore. Mrs. Ard grew fond of him and sought to teach him to read and write. By the time her irate husband discovered the deed and put a stop to it, Douglass had acquired enough of the rudiments to carry on by himself. His life in Baltimore was interrupted in 1832 at the death of Captain Anthony. Frederick was passed along to the possession of Thomas Ard, Anthony's son-in-law. The lessons he learned about the evils of slavery and his hatred of the institution was deepened during his stay with Thomas Ard. He infuriated the Ards by his refusal to call his owner master. Determined to crush the spirit of young Frederick, Thomas Ard hired him out to Edward Covey, a slave breaker who worked and whipped him mercilessly. He endured the mistreatment until one day he could stand it no longer and fought back. Soon thereafter, Fred was again sent to Baltimore, where he met Anna Murray. His love for and encouragement from Anna, a free black woman, heightened his quest to be a free man. On September 3rd, 1838, Douglass, dressed in a sailor's uniform and carrying identification papers provided by a free black seaman, managed to reach New York City. There he met David Ruggles, an abolitionist, who sheltered Douglass and assisted him with his wedding plans. Frederick changed his surname from Bailey to Douglas, married Anna Murray, and the couple moved to New Bedford, Massachusetts. Douglas began reading The Liberator and frequented anti-slavery meetings. By the way, The Liberator was the paper of the abolitionist movement, one of the official papers. Now, on one occasion, he was called upon to speak in the presence of some of the most prominent abolitionists, William Lloyd Garrison, Wendell Phillips, and William Collins. Douglas told his story, and he was immediately urged to become an anti-slavery lecturer. His towering, erect posture depicted dignity and strength, and when he spoke, his voice was a rich, powerful baritone. These attributes, when taken together, gave Douglas quite a commanding presence. Yet, he provided more than just a mere presence. His enunciation and command of the English language armed him with a profound argument, which he reinforced by employing a quick wit and vivid imagery to describe the horror of slavery. So eloquent were his speeches that after a while the public began to wonder if this well-versed man was ever a slave. At the risk of capture, Douglas chose to remove this doubt by pushing an account of his slave experiences. Narrative of the Life of Frederick Douglass was published in 1845. His freedom, jeopardized by the detailed documentation presented in this book, Douglass fled to England and remained overseas for 2 years. With the financial aid of his European friends, Douglass returned to America, legally secured his freedom, and launched his paper, The North Star. Douglass wrote scathing editorials on a variety of topics. Slavery was just one of his targets. About the need to remain adamantly concerned about the plight of slaves, he wrote, and I quote, "Those who profess to favor freedom and yet depreciate agitation are men who want crops without plowing up the ground," unquote. In an effort to attack job discrimination against blacks, he wrote, and I quote, "We need mechanics as well as ministers. We must build as well as live in these houses. We must construct bridges as well as pass over them," unquote. He responded to the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 by writing that the, quote, "true remedy," unquote, to the legislation was, quote, "a good revolver, a steady hand, and a determination to shoot down any man attempting to kidnap a fugitive slave," unquote. During this period, Douglass also found time to publish his autobiography, My Bondage and My Freedom, in 1855. Douglass was a man of action as well. His previous belief in, quote, "moral suasion," unquote, was becoming dissatisfactory to him, and he began implementing more active ways to show his convictions. He focused attention on Jim Crow laws in the North by entering public places in which he knew these laws were enforced, sometimes risking physical ejection. He also gave his money to aid fugitive slaves and used his printing shop in Rochester, New York, as an underground railroad station. In addition, he became impressed with the radical abolitionist John Brown, whose advocacy of revolutionary means to end slavery intrigued Douglass. However, he decided against joining Brown in his plan to overthrow the government. Still, his involvement with Brown was visible enough that a warrant for Douglass's arrest was issued after the Harper Ferry raid, and Douglass had to again flee. This time, he went away to Canada for several months. Very, very often, people from a nationalist perspective may attack, I think unjustly, Frederick Douglass because he was married to a white woman, believing that, you know, this meant that he was a real, you know, an integrationist and was trying to play the colorblind game. But I hope if you heard that, obviously he wasn't. It's true that he was married to a white woman, but in fact, he gave work to a union shop up at his facility for the North to print the North Star. And unfortunately, when he himself, you know, when he had his son, his first son, he wanted his first son to become a union printer. And unfortunately, his first son was refused membership in that union. And, well, I would say Douglass had some very choice words on this matter.
You know, Gerald, we're going to be talking about Harriet Tubman in a second. And as we talk about this other side of black history, this is a side of Frederick Douglass that I was not aware of. I'm sure many other people were not aware of. The fact that his response to the Fugitive Slave Act, which made it legal, made it law throughout the land, that if no matter where you are, if you're in the North, if you're in the West, and you see a fugitive slave, you are duty-bound to return them to captivity. You are duty-bound to return that property to its master. And because we know how things usually go, we know how many free black folk were kidnapped and sold into slavery.
Absolutely.
Based upon this fugitive slave law. To hear him say that the true remedy to this legislation is to get your gat, hold your hand steady, that's encouraging to me. And that also talks about where you say his lack of patience with moral suasion, that talks about the split that occurred in the abolitionist movement.
That is correct.
Which we can talk about at another point.
Come down from that mountain, Harry. Come down to the valley at night. Come down to your weeping people and be their guiding light. Sing, Deep River. Don't you want to cross over today? Sing, Deep River. Don't you want to walk on freedom's way? I stole down in the nighttime. I come back in the day. I stole back to Maryland to guide the slaves away. You better run, brave Harriet. There's ransom on your head. You better run, Miss Harriet. They want you alive or dead. I've been down in the valleys yonder and searching around the stills. They got a posse after you, a riding through the hills. They got bloodhounds smelling. They got the guns cocked too. You better run, bold Harriet. The white man's after you. They got $10,000 put on your cold black head. They'll give $10,000. They mad because you fled. I'm Harriet Tubman, people. I'm Harriet the slave. I'm Harriet, free woman, and I'm free beyond my grave.
Harriet Tubman was born in 1820 in Dorchester County, Maryland. She had the hard childhood of a slave, much work, little schooling, severe punishment. In 1848, she escaped, leaving behind her husband, John Tubman, who threatened to report her to their master. Can you say Uncle Tom, boys and girls? As a free woman, she began to devise practical ways of helping other slaves escape. Over the following 10 years, she made about 20 trips from the North into the South and rescued more than 300 slaves. Her reputation spread rapidly, and she won the admiration of leading abolitionists, some of whom even sheltered her passengers. Eventually, a reward of $40,000 was posted for her capture. Tubman met and aided John Brown in recruiting soldiers for his raid on Harper's Ferry. Brown referred to her as General Tubman. One of her major disappointments was the failure of the raid, and she is said to have regarded Brown as the true emancipator of her people, not Abraham Lincoln. In 1860, she began to canvass the nation, appearing at anti-slavery meetings and speaking on women's rights. Shortly before the outbreak of the Civil War, she was forced to leave for Canada. But she returned to the United States and served the Union as a soldier and a spy, and sometimes as a nurse. She was particularly valuable to the Union Army as a scout because of the knowledge of the terrain she had gained as a conductor on the Underground Railroad. Tubman's first biography, from which she received the proceeds, was written by Sarah Bradford in 1868. Her husband John died 2 years after the end of the war, and in 1869 she married a war veteran, Nelson Davis. Despite receiving many honors and tributes, including a medal from Queen Victoria, she spent her last days in relative poverty, not receiving a pension from the Union Army until 30 years after the Civil War. With the $20 a month pension that she finally received, she helped to found a home for the aged and needy, later renamed the Harriet Tubman Home. She died in Auburn, New York in 1913. Visitors to Auburn, New York today can still go to the Harriet Tubman Home. There have been other biographies written on Harriet Tubman just recently within the last year. One of these biographies you can get on the internet. It's called Jailbreak Out of History, the Rebiography of Harriet Tubman. And it's written by a woman by the name of Butch Lee. And Butch Lee argues that Harriet Tubman has become trivialized and exceptionalized exceptionalized because of her history. Her argument is that white, patriarchal, capitalist history cannot allow us, black people, white people, people of color, to see Harriet as the strong Amazon that she was, toting a shotgun, ready to use it. And so they have to make her the exception. They have to stress the fact that she was a nurse in the Union Army. Harriet Tubman was a soldier in the Union Army. Harriet Tubman was a soldier before the Union Army. It's interesting that it was Frederick Douglass who introduced Harriet and John Brown. And when Gerald talked about the fact that at the last moment Frederick Douglass decided not to support it, he meant Frederick Douglass decided not to go with him on it. He supported it. Right. But he just wasn't going to get down with him, which is why he put him in touch with Harriet, who was sure enough about it. Harriet was trying to get there, but I think she missed the appointment. So Harriet was about to roll with John Brown on this raid. Part of her disappointment that it failed is she felt like if I had been there, it would have been a different outcome. See, Harriet was about it. Harriet was not an exception, as Butch Lee argues in her book, Jailbreak Out of History. Harriet was a product of her environment. That slave environment created women, children, and men who were able to respond to enslavement. This is part of that legacy of liberation that we don't always hear about when we talk about Black History Month. This is part of that legacy of liberation that we have attempted to bring you today in this collaborative effort between Rootwork and Slave Revolt Radio.
Another side of Black history. The idea of Black History Month has always filled me with ambivalence. On the one hand, there's understandable pride in the accomplishments of one's ancestors, people who fought long and hard for their place in the sun against monstrous odds and indeed against American white supremacist terrorism. They used every means imaginable to sustain themselves against a system that was predicated and dedicated to their spiritual, psychological, and material destruction. When one studies the life of, say, Harriet Tubman or other freedom fighters like her, it is almost impossible not to be moved. On the other hand, the institutionalization of Black History Month by corporate and political America has resulted in a kind of dead history, by which I mean the uses of advertising and even stamps to promote historical figures, many from the distant past, who portray a safe side to a history that was and is anything but safe. This has resulted in the promotion of Black historical figures as one-dimensional icons or advertising gimmicks that reduce them to familiar names but little else of substance. Thus, Martin Luther King Jr. becomes the icon of choice, used by everything from insurance companies to dry cleaners to drum up business among the burgeoning Black middle and working class. It has contributed to the selling of Black history as something that looks almost endearingly to the past, as if there is not an awful lot of Black history to be made today. There's also a deep, troubling bourgeois factor in popular Black history that seems to remember the well-to-do, yet ignores those who struggled from among the ranks of the poor, who didn't wear clean suits every day, and didn't think of the vote that it represented the end-all and be-all of the struggle. I speak of the forgotten ones, those people who fought for freedom and Black liberation, not at news conferences or in the editorial board meetings with board journalists, but in the fields, in the shops, in the streets, among the people. In this new kind of bourgeois safe corporate Black history, people such as these make no real appearance. It's almost as if these agencies strive to create a kind of Black history light that will not disturb the sleep or the stomach of white Americans. This is a shame and a disservice to both white and Black Americans and all who really want to know about the history of this nation. It is therefore fitting to recall those names of people who lived in the hearts and minds of their people and who in their own way fought for freedom, but are rarely mentioned in most history books and won't be seen on U.S. postage stamps, at least anytime soon. For capitalism, if anything, learns how to co-opt almost everything for profit, right? Here are a few. Will there be any postage stamps to honor the historical contributions of Dr. Huey P. Newton, founder of the Black Panther Party? To Ramona Africa, the courageous fighter and resistor who survived an urban Holocaust on May 13, 1985. To George or Jonathan Jackson. to Rochelle McGee, a brilliant jailhouse lawyer whose work has led to the freedom of over 40 younger men, but who is perhaps the longest held black political prisoner in the Americas, to the great Seminole warrior, Coacoochee, also called Wildcat, who fought for black and red freedom from the American slavers, and his brother fighter, John Horse. Coacoochee and Horse fought over 400 American outlaws, soldiers, and bandits in 1851 in northern Mexico, and beat them with 60 Seminole braves. I don't think so. You see, black history isn't safe. It's challenging and troubling, and speaks to the lives we live now under the illusion of freedom. It ain't Martin Luther King alone, but the many who followed and the many who did not. Why not jettison Black History Month, just as Black History Week was jettisoned? Why not a Black Liberation Month that would concentrate our minds not only on history, but on the sometimes painful lessons of history? More importantly, it would point us to the undiscovered land that beckons us all, the future. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are produced by Noel Hanrahan for Prison Radio.
This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're listening to A History of Black Resistance with Mama Kaliba and Gerald Smith of Berkeley Liberation Radio. You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, or Free Radio Asheville. We continue.
Well, now we're going to talk about modern-day resistance, political prisoners. Right now, we want to examine the case of Marshal Eddie Conway. Eddie Conway is the former leader of the Black Panther Party of Baltimore, and in my opinion, one of the most upstanding political prisoners we have today. Marshal Eddie Conway continues to maintain his innocence of a police murder in 1970. Eddie states that he was falsely implicated in the murder of one Baltimore City police officer and the assault and attempted murder of two other officers. Eddie states, "At no time in my life have I killed or attempted to kill anyone. I have no involvement with that incident. I'm innocent." Eddie claims to be the target of the local police and the FBI's counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO, which was designed to destroy individuals and organizations that were considered to be politically objectionable to the ruling class. Eddie asserts that he is one of many political prisoners in the United States as a result of FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover's and Assistant Director William Sullivan's war against the Black Panther Party. According to political accounts, shortly after 9 p.m. on the night of April 24, 1970, Officer Donald Sager and Officer Stanley Sirokoski, by the way, who now feels that Eddie should be released, they responded to a domestic complaint. When they arrived at 1201 Myrtle Avenue, they talked to a woman who said she was afraid of her abusive husband. After the investigation, the officers returned to their car to make out their report. While writing their report, three men walked past the patrol car. The woman who made the complaint signaled from her door for the officers to return to her home. When the officers opened the door of the car to get out, a hail of gunfire hit the car from behind. One officer was shot four times in the stomach and in both hands. The other officer was shot in the head while still seated in the car. He was later pronounced dead at the hospital. The officer that was shot in the stomach managed to reach the car radio and call for help. Not far from the crime scene, Officer Roger Nolan and Officer James Welch received the dispatch call and responded. Based on the information received about the direction in which the assailants fled, the officers went in pursuit of the suspects.